welcome to Tuned to Yesterday, broadcasting programs from radio's golden age. I'm your host, Mark Levanier. In this hour, true history. Later on, we hear a story of the early American settlers on the Cavalcade of America. But right now, the self-proclaimed father of radio, Lee DeForest, is profiled on the Hallmark Hall of Fame with his life story from February 7th, 1954 on CBS, featuring host Lionel Barrymore and a cast of CBS actors like Parley Bear, John Daner, Vic Perrin, and Larry Dobkin. Dr. DeForest appears in the broadcast as well.
Remember, a Hallmark card when you care enough to send the very best. Tonight, from Hollywood, the makers of Hallmark cards bring you an unusual true story on the Hallmark Hall of Fame. And here is our distinguished host, Mr. Lionel Barrymore.
Good evening, ladies and gentlemen, and welcome to the Hallmark Hall of Fame, where we offer you true stories about real people. As the sound of my voice reaches you tonight, so do the efforts and heartbreak of a very brave man, Dr. Lee DeForest, the father of radio. His inventive genius in the field of electronics opened for all the world and all the ages the invisible empire of the air we call radio. Here is a remarkable story of one man's victory over complete despair. We'll hear it in just a moment. And we'll meet some very special guests later in the broadcast. Now, here's Frank Gore.
Valentine's Day next week is the day when you express your feelings and your good taste through Valentine. You can do both if you choose Hallmark Valentine. You'll find the loving messages you want in the simple, unaffected words you would use. And humorous Valentine, but designed with the good taste you demand. And the Hallmark on the back will tell your friends that on Valentine's Day, too, you care enough to send the very best. Lionel Barrymore appears by arrangement with Metro-Goldwyn-Mayer, who celebrates their 30th anniversary at your favorite theater with The Long, Long Thriller, starring Lucille Ball and Desi Arnaz. And now Mr. Barrymore brings you tonight's story on the Hallmark Hall of Fame.
Mass reunion, New Haven, Connecticut, June 1906. Like all reunions, the day has been filled with hilarity, pledges of eternal friendship, banquets, and speeches.
Gentlemen. Gentlemen, as I recall, this was and still is the hungriest class ever graduated from Yale University. Officially, and on behalf of the faculty and trustees, it is my distinct pleasure to extend to all of you a cordial welcome back. Ten years ago at this time, most of you were quivering in anticipation of your final examination. I'm certain that in the 10 years you have been away from here, all of you have discovered that life has a way of holding final examinations more frequently than they ever occurred on this campus. On this unserious event of your 10th reunion, I mention this serious aspect of living by way of introducing one of your fellow classmates. Not only do you and I know him, but the world knows him now. His fame is well earned. For he and he alone is responsible for the fact that American wireless telegraphy leads the world. Gentlemen, I give you your comrade and classmate, Lee DeForest.
Thank you, sir. I didn't prepare a speech for tonight. That's all right, Lee. You just tell us how we can become inventors.
Yeah. Tell us how to do it.
Well, I'd say you need three things. First, an idea. And secondly, a landlord who isn't too good at accounting. And thirdly, and this is the hardest, find a stomach that can go without food. And that's about all I have to say.
Well, that isn't all we have to say, Lee. I think I speak for every man here at this decennial when I say we're very proud of you, Lee.
Thank you, sir.
Gentlemen, Lee DeForest. I thought I might find you out here.
Hello, Professor.
Well, Lee, is it good to be back in New Haven?
Hearing voices, seeing faces, shaking hands. No man could feel more gratification than I feel tonight. Being honored by all my old friends.
No. It was our honor, Lee. You're a world-famous inventor now. And I'm a little famous, too. You'd be surprised how many freshmen come here and ask me if I was the one who taught Lee DeForest. No, seriously, Lee, you are an inspiration to every man in this school. You started with nothing more than your two hands and an idea. Now you're at the pinnacle. Your own inventions and patents and wireless telegraphy and your own company, too.
Well, it sounds impressive, Professor, but it's not exactly my own company. I'm the director of the American DeForest Wireless Telegraph Company.
Mm.
A lot of other people involved in it, too. I leave the business pretty much up to them.
Yeah. What's the future going to be now, Lee?
Well, I was thinking of that, Professor. Off and on, I've had a chance to work on an idea I have of transmitting the voice.
The voice? You mean like a wireless telephone?
Yes. I think it can be done. Voice, music even. Well, you asked me, Professor.
You haven't changed a bit, Lee. You just described something that would be a miracle if it ever came about, and you sound as though you were going to finish it off tomorrow morning before breakfast.
It would be a miracle. Well, maybe it's just a dream.
A very good dream, Lee.
Gentlemen, would you please let me through? Gentlemen, I'm afraid I don't know what you're talking about.
I'm sorry, I'm late.
Lord, these men from the newspaper.
Yeah, I thought they'd be around. Mr. DeForest has no statement to make right now. Come on. No statement. Come on.
What is it, George? You look worried.
Oh, there's trouble, Lee. I didn't want them to get at you first.
Was it that bad?
The company's going under. The people who've been running things haven't been doing such a good job.
Well, I can't believe that, George. We've got more orders for equipment right now than we can fill.
Oh, that isn't it. There's been some manipulation and mismanagement.
But how?
When you went to England on those installations, they began to promote DeForest stock in a big way. Now they've oversold it.
Oversold?
And they formed a new company to take over the assets. It's their way out of a jam.
Yes, but my name is on the company.
I'm afraid they also control all of your patents. Looks like you'll have to go along with them.
No, I don't have to go along with anybody, George. I'll resign.
Lee, you've worked and starved. Your inventions are what made that company.
I can't do anything else, George. I won't be party to anything like that.
Now, gentlemen, we can make this brief. This letter came to my office this morning. I hereby tender my resignation as Vice President and Director of the American DeForest Wireless Telegraph Company, the same to take effect immediately,
And it is signed Lee DeForest.
Oh, there you are.
Dr. DeForest is a very straightforward man. He's apparently unsympathetic with our views of expansion. He enclosed all of his shares of stock with a letter of resignation.
Mr. Chairman.
Yes?
What about the patents on all the equipment?
Well, naturally, those come with the stock.
Oh,
all that we are interested in retaining. As a matter of fact, all but one, which is now pending. Let's see, I have... Oh, yes, here we are. Yeah, this is something he calls an audion detector.
And I never heard of it. What is it?
Oh, it's some sort of an amplifier he's worked on now and then for a wireless telephone. Completely impractical. Our engineers have assured me this little gadget is of no value to our organization.
Oh, well, that's all right.
Now to the question of financial compensation.
Yes, how much is it going to cost us to get rid of him?
Yeah, well,
I don't think we should give him over $50,000.
The financial aspects have already been solved.
Huh?
Dr. DeForest has received $1,000 for his services to the company, paid in full.
$1,000?
And so much for Dr. Lee DeForest's career, gentlemen.
Phenomena of radio was scarcely more than a dream in the mind of Lee DeForest when his world crashed about him. Heartbreak and disappointment were not new to him, but success had been sweet. And the new heartbreak and disappointment was particularly bitter.
Hi. Well, quite a city, isn't it? I can remember it wasn't many years ago they used gas instead of electricity for those signs. Remember?
Yes, I remember.
All right, so you have the place all cleaned up. Not very big, but you should be able to get some work done here. Lee?
Huh?
Lee, you can't just sit there looking out the window. Lee, they didn't take everything.
No, they didn't. I still have one patent.
And you've always had faith in that idea of a wireless telephone. Lee, I know how hard you work, and I know what you've lost, but this isn't the end. After all, you're only 33. You're a world-famous inventor. And if you don't want to go to work on this amplifying idea, you can take your pick of any job with a big electrical company. Well, you know more about wireless than any man alive. Just give yourself a chance.
Hey, Lee. I wish I'd never seen any of it, ever.
I'll drop in tomorrow, Lee. Good night.
Good night.
Where'd you forget, George?
How do you do, sir? I'm John Hogan.
You are?
Yes, sir. I wrote you a letter, Dr. DeForest, about working for you as your assistant. I wonder if I could talk to you about it.
No.
Didn't you get my letter, sir?
Yes, I got it, but what was it exactly? I forget.
Well, I want to go to Sheffield Scientific School at Yale, the same as you, sir. I want to be an inventor.
I am no longer with the company, boy. I don't have any facilities. I don't think you'd be interested in my future work.
I wish you'd give me a chance, Doctor. Just a week, maybe. Just to be around
you. I told you I'm not in wireless telegraphy anymore.
I know, sir. But once you said that wireless telegraphy was only the beginning, that there's a lot more to be done with ether waves besides sending and receiving.
Where'd you hear that, son?
Why? I've read everything you ever said, Dr. DeForest. So have a lot of others just like me. Well, I'm sorry if I bothered you, Doctor. Good night, sir.
Good night. Wait.
Yes, sir?
Why are you so interested in wireless?
Oh, I guess anybody would be interested in those waves out there. We can't see them, but they can do wonderful things for us. Of course, I don't understand too much about it, but I say it's a miracle.
How old are you, son?
17.
You want to work with the miracle?
Yes, sir.
Son, you come back here tomorrow morning. We'll start in together. Now, the basic problem is to devise and develop the proper electromagnetic ear. If it can be made sensitive enough, it'll not only pick up telegraph signals, but also spoken words.
Will that ever be possible?
Well, if we can heat those incandescent gases properly.
You showed me the gas test.
Yes, and that's impractical. Says carbon. At least in this form. But if we use a carbon filament...
I'm a lamp manufacturer, Doctor.
Yes, I know that. But could you possibly consider a little job like this? Now, I want an incandescent lamp shaped in such a way as to hold this carbon filament and this small plate and an optimum amount of gas. Can you do it?
Well, I suppose I can try.
What's it going to be?
I hope it's going to be a vacuum tube detector.
A vacuum tube detector?
What's that? You ready, John?
Yes, sir. Is the filament blowing?
Yes. Let it heat a little more.
All right?
Well, it should be all right. And, tap the microphone.
Are you tapping it? Yes, sir, I am.
Now, wait. And I'll try again.
Hear anything?
No.
Maybe we weren't connected right.
No, the connection's all right. There's something else. Something's missing.
Well, we'll just have to keep trying. Yes, sir.
Who is it? What do you want?
It's me.
Dr. DeForest? Oh, what are you doing here at this hour?
Mr. McCandless, can you make me another tube?
Well, I can't at this hour, Doctor. I figure that's right now.
Mr. McCandless, listen to me. This is very important. I want a different shape on the tube. May I come in? Thank you. Now, something like this. Cylindrical, you see?
I see.
And then I want to add a third electrode. The two just are not going to do what I want them to do.
Oh, they aren't.
Oh, that's too bad. Well, don't you see, Mr. McCandless, a third electrode located as close as possible to the filament will increase the sensitivity.
It will, huh?
Yes, of course it will. That's what'll make all the difference in the world. Now, when can we have it?
You mind if I get some sleep first? And then tell you?
Close the window, John. We need it quiet. They're out to celebrate New Year's Eve.
Yes, I almost forgot.
It's almost midnight now.
Yes, sir.
John, I suppose you'd rather be any place, but you're working.
I'd rather see how this works than be anywhere else.
Good boy. Come on.
Over here?
Yeah. Move it off of that corner.
That's all right over here?
Yeah, that'll do it. Have you got a handkerchief?
Yes, sir.
Take it out.
No. What do you want me to do, sir?
I'll give you the count. Drop it on three.
What?
Well, if this is as sensitive as it should be, we ought to be able to hear a handkerchief drop.
But, Doctor,
it's heating up. Now. Yes. You ready?
Ready.
One. Two. Three.
Did you hear it? Did you hear it, sir?
I heard it. I heard it all the way over here. A handkerchief dropping.
You mean it works? You mean it works? It does work. My voice came all the way across the laboratory.
And if it could cross the laboratory, it could cross an ocean eventually. It could go around the world. A way to communicate not with just one person, but thousands of them at the same time. With this, a whole world could be as close as this switch.
It's a miracle, sir.
Thank you, John.
Thanks for your help.
Across the laboratory that New Year's Eve of 1906, and the little glass tube that Lee DeForest had worked so hard perfecting became the basis upon which every radio and television set in America today is founded. Truly, Dr. Lee DeForest can be called the father of radio. And tonight, to join in our salute, are two distinguished gentlemen who can truly be called the fathers of radio entertainment. Ladies and gentlemen, Freeman Gosden and Charles Correll. You also know him as Amos and Andy. Now, here's the gentleman you know best as Amos, Freeman Gosden.
Thank you, Lionel. It is really our pleasure to be here tonight to pay tribute to Lee DeForest. I doubt if any man in modern times has done more to bring joy and entertainment to America and to the world than has Dr. DeForest. Don't you agree, Charlie?
Yes, I certainly do. And you know, Lionel, Freeman and I started in radio back in 1925. In those days, we realized the true miracle that is radio. Tonight's show, in many ways, will serve to remind us that men like Lee DeForest have helped build our American way of life.
Well, thank you, Freeman and Charlie. And say, if I'm not mistaken, aren't you fellas doing a bit of biography on your own show next Sunday?
As a matter of fact, we are, Lionel.
Yes.
On our Rexall show next Sunday, Charlie and I are going to dramatize our own life story.
Well, that should be fun for everyone. And we'll all certainly be listening to Amos and Andy next week. Meanwhile, thank you for joining us on the Hallmark Hall of Fame here tonight. Freeman Gosden and Charles Correll. It isn't often, ladies and gentlemen, that a man's privileged to know the full measure of his achievement in his lifetime. However, not so with Lee DeForest. Today, at the age of 80, when the past of most men is far behind them, Dr. DeForest still looks to the future. Daily, he reports for work at his laboratory to fashion, among other things, a gas-operated television set, which he hopes to lead to the school children of the nation as a memorial demonstration of how gas can produce electricity. It's called the thermocouple principle. The thermofile will be installed in the television set of Dr. DeForest's own make and placed on permanent exhibition in Chicago. With Dr. DeForest, life apparently begins at 80.
Life can begin at any age, Mr. Barrymore, as long as the man is willing to meet the challenge of the fast-moving world around him, even though the pitfalls and obstacles are great. This is Lee DeForest. Looking back now from the safe distance of nearly half a century, I realize that it is often those very pitfalls and obstacles that have made my life interesting to me. But the most profound thing I have learned is that truth is absolutely independent of advantage or desire. My thanks to you, Mr. Barrymore, and to the makers of Hallmark cards for the honor you have paid me tonight.
About this time on Sunday evening, I imagine you mothers of young children begin to think of the long week ahead and wonder how you'll keep the youngsters quiet and entertained at least part of the time. Well, I have a perfect solution. Let them make some Hallmark Make Your Own Valentine. It's wonderful fun and constructive, too. These Hallmark Make Your Own Valentines are simple punch-outs that don't require scissors or paste. You can buy sets for different ages, separate sets for boys and girls, too, and the finished valentines are as cute as any you buy. You will recognize these sets of Hallmark Make Your Own Valentines by the Hallmark and Crown on the package. The symbol that says, when you care enough to send the very best. And now, here again is Lionel Barrymore.
It's been a great pleasure and privilege to honor Dr. Lee DeForest tonight. Well, as you know, this program and the Television Hallmark Hall of Fame were singled out for commendation when the National Association for Better Radio and Television announced that Mr. Joyce C. Hall, president of Hallmark Card, had won the Dr. Lee DeForest Award last year. So we feel a particular fondness for the name of DeForest, as well as a great respect for all he's done. Now, Frank, tell us about next week's program.
Next week, Mr. Barrymore, the Hallmark Hall of Fame is proud to present Miss Jane Wyman, starring in a true story about Mary Todd Lincoln.
Oh, well, that sounds delightful, Frank. By the way, I believe you have a special announcement.
Here's an important announcement from the makers of Hallmark cards. Boys and girls of high school age can win big cash prizes for themselves and for their schools in the Hallmark Hall of Fame contest. All you do is nominate a person for the Hallmark Hall of Fame and tell in a brief essay why you chose that person. See the February 3rd issues of Scholastic magazines for full details on the rules and cash prizes for the Hallmark Hall of Fame contest.
Until next week, then, this is Lionel Barrymore saying good night.
Hallmark cards that are sold only in stores that have been carefully selected to give you expert and friendly service. Remember, a Hallmark card when you care enough to send the very best. Our producer-director is William Frood. Our script tonight was written by E. Jack Newman. Featured in our cast were Pauly Baer, John Daner, Vic Perrin, Lawrence Dobkin, Sam Edwards, and Howard McNear. This is Frank Goss, saying goodnight to you until next week at the same time, when we'll present the true story of Mary Todd Lincoln, starring Miss Jane Wyman. And in the weeks to come, true stories from the lives of Simon Bolivar, Bernard Baruch, and the story of Nurse Edith Cavell, starring Miss Helen Hayes, on the Hallmark Hall of Fame. This is the CBS Radio Network.
This is KMBC, Kansas City, Missouri.
The Hallmark Hall of Fame on Tuned to Yesterday from February 7th, 1954 on CBS. It's an hour of true history on Tuned to Yesterday. I'm your host, Mark Levanier. And now the Cavalcade of America program, whose producers made a very important decision for radio in the mid-1930s, and that was switching their musical format to stories of our Americana, producing over 500 broadcasts. Now, as we listen to these, they prove to be a great contribution to the stories of our country. This next episode from May 27, 1952, called The Valley of the Swans, telling the tale of early settlers in Delaware. With movie star Dana Andrews, it's Irv Tunick's story, The Valley of the Swans.
This cavalcade broadcast, The Valley of the Swans, is coming to you directly from the Seaford Nylon Plant in Seaford, Sussex County, Delaware, home of the DuPont Company's first nylon plant. The DuPont Company of Wilmington, Delaware, makers of better things for better living through chemistry, presents the Cavalcade of America. Tonight's stars, Dana Andrews and Louise Allbritton. Tonight's story, The Valley of the Swans. Sussex County, the most southerly of Delaware's three counties, is a land rich in tradition. The site of one of the earliest settlements on the North American continent. Our story tells of one of these settlements, Swanondale. A brief chapter of almost forgotten history. And now with Dana Andrews and Louise Allbritton, as Peter and Catherine Plockoy, here is the Valley of the Swans. There
are some who say Swannendale is gone, wiped from the face of the earth by the hands of time. I say it is not gone. I say its roots are deep in the land, and it flourishes even yet. You can crush a fort, lay low a town, but an idea, a principle, a dream is unconquerable. You today reap the rich bounty of Swannendale. Listen, then judge the truth of that statement for yourself. This true story of our adventure begins on the fifth day of May, 289 years ago this month, the year 1663. It begins with 25 Mennonite families, 41 souls, standing on the deck of the little ship St. Jacob, watching the shores of Holland fade off in the distance. My wife, Catherine, stood beside me, and as the last hint of land disappeared, she turned from the rail.
I can't see the shore anymore, Peter. It's gone. Gone as if a careful Dutch housewife had scrubbed the last bit of dirt off the horizon.
Sorry to see it go, Catherine?
Why should I be sorry?
Everything you ever knew or had is back there. Your family, home, friends.
Perhaps. But everything I want is ahead. No, I'm not sorry. Not one bit.
Nor afraid?
No. Fear is for the lonely, Peter. Wherever we go, if we go together, I'll never know fear.
Well, Catherine, look. I bought this book at a stall just before we came aboard. It tells of explorations along the South River. The English call it Delaware, just near where we're going. Listen to what it says. Heaven and earth never agreed better to frame a place for man's habitation.
Everyone who has seen America says the same thing.
Here it is on this map, just beyond this little cape. That's the Hawkill, or Swannendale, as it's sometimes called.
Swannendale, the Valley of the Swans. Even the name has the sound of peace. Weeks of our voyage were uneventful. But then, about the third week out, I noticed a strange uneasiness take hold of many of the men and women in our company. When I came on deck with Peter, they would make some excuse to go below, or they would remain silent and curiously aloof.
I don't understand it, Catherine.
What's happening?
Well, I don't know, but I'm going to find out now. Come along. Oh, Jan, just a minute.
Huh? Oh, it's you, Peter.
Jan, what's the matter?
Why, nothing, Peter.
We've been friends for many years. I have a right to ask you to be honest with me.
Well, Peter, it's not me. Not me alone. The others...
What about the others?
Well, they say that you should have told them about what happened before at Swannendale when some of the others tried to settle there. You hid it from them. At least that's what they say.
I hid nothing? What happened at Swannendale?
The first Dutch settlement, 28 men slaughtered by the Indians.
No.
Who told you this?
Captain Van der Hoost. He says he was with Captain De Vries when they came to Swannendale and found the bodies. Now, why didn't you tell us that before we left, Peter?
Well, how could I tell you what I didn't know? And why didn't you come to me when the captain first told you the story?
Well, we were going to, as soon as we decided.
Decided what? Stop stammering, Jan. Tell me everything.
Well... Captain Van der Hoost has offered to take us to New Amstel. He says the patroons there will treat us well, employ us on their plantations.
Oh, so that's it. Catherine, we're going up to the captain's deck. Come on.
But what if it's true?
We'll see. We've got to get to the bottom of this, and quickly.
All of our company, on deck. On deck, everyone. On deck.
Here. What's going on here? What's the meaning of this?
Captain Van der Hoost, I'll ask you to stand here with me.
You can't give orders on my ship.
I'm not giving orders. I'm only calling a meeting of my company, and I want you to be present.
I could have you chained for this.
Possibly. Friends, I understand that our worthy captain has taken great pains to circulate a story about an Indian massacre at Swannendale. Is that true, Captain?
Yes, it's true. What of it?
When did that take place?
In 1632.
Over 30 years ago.
30 years doesn't mend the manners of a savage.
I don't think God ever made a savage. He only made men. Why were the settlers massacred?
What difference does that make? And besides, I don't have to answer questions on my own ship.
Well, answer one question, if you will, sir. Isn't it true that the patroons of New Amstel offer a bounty for every servant you bring in? Isn't that true? You stand to make a handsome profit if this company is put ashore at New Amstel instead of Swannendale. That's the truth, isn't it?
Listen to me, all you people. If you want to entrust your lives with this man, this crazy man who will take you unarmed and unprotected among the savages, then you deserve whatever you get. In New Amstel, there's a fort. Soldiers, you'll be safe.
Yes, you'll be safe. Safe and enslaved. Is that what you want?
There's something to what the captain says, Peter. It's true we won't have everything we counted on, but, well, at least we'll be safe.
How safe will you be? Will you be safe from your own conscience? Have we traveled all these miles to exchange one form of indignity for another? Let's just consider why we're here. First, we want the freedom to practice our own form of religion. And second, we believe that each man has the right to hold property and to keep his property separate from that of his neighbor.
Peter, I know these things, and if it were just for myself, I would agree to go to Swannendale with you gladly, but I'm not thinking of myself.
Who are you thinking of?
The women. I feel we can't take this chance because of the women.
May I answer that, Peter?
Oh, yes, Captain. Go on.
The things we want. The things Peter just talked about. They're as precious to us as women as they are to you as men. Perhaps even more precious. For these things are for the future. For our children more than for ourselves. And that's where a woman thinks. And dreams. With her children. I don't want my children to be born to slavery.
We are
going for Swannendale. We're going to Swannendale.
Yes. Well, is that agreed then?
Yes.
All right. We'll call this meeting ended. Then came that bright, that glorious day. On the 21st of July, 1663, the San Jacob rounded the cape now known as Henlopen, and we had our first view of the dunes of the Hawk Hills, of Swannendale, the low, gray shoreline, unbroken by even the shape of a solitary tree. And then suddenly the shore seemed alive. Millions of wild swans crowded the shoreline, and somehow the flapping of their great wings seemed a symbol of greeting. By twilight, we were all ashore.
Well, Buckeye, one last chance. I can still take you and your party back on board the St. Jacob.
This is our destination. We'll stay.
You can still change your mind.
There's no reason to, Captain.
No. Just listen. You hear those drums? Beyond the dunes is the forest. And in the forest, watching, are the Indians. And the sound of the drums, they're planning a welcome party for you. I hope it meets your pleasure. Bosun!
Sir.
We're going back to the ship. That fool Plutoy and his company are staying here.
Aye, aye, sir. All right, man the oars. Look lively now. All right. Long strokes now.
For a long while, we watched as the men at the oars fought the pounding surf. And then they were beyond the breakers, off into the twilight and the distance. And with each stroke, the sound of the drum seemed to grow louder and nearer. We stood and shivered until Peter broke the silence.
I will read from the 21st chapter of Revelation, first verse. And I saw a new heaven and a new earth. For the first heaven and the first earth were passed away, and there was no more sea. We will pray. America, starring Dana Andrews and Louise Allbritton as Peter and Catherine Plockhoy in The Valley of the Swan. Sponsored by the DuPont Company, makers of better things for better living through chemistry.
Ladies and gentlemen, it might be interesting to know that quite some time after our story tonight, The Valley of the Swans, there was another pioneer who settled in Delaware. This man's name was Eleuther Irénée DuPont, and he founded the company which now bears his name. This was back in 1802, so this year is the 150th anniversary year of the DuPont Company, maker of better things for better living through chemistry. It was a night of unrelieved terror, that first night at Swanendale. Beyond the dunes, the forest seemed to throb with war drums. We were only 41 souls, stranded on a strange and foreign shore, a little isle of silence set between the pounding surf and the booming drums.
But morning came at last. A bright, sunlit morning that gave us comfort. Strangely, the drums were suddenly quiet. Then we started for the deserted fort.
We trudged together over the sand dunes. Huge drifts of sand that stood like eerie sentinels guarding the unknown wilderness beyond. And then we came to the fort, a dismal place haunted by the memory of death. The palisades were broken, rotted. The ground was covered by a matting of moss and weeds.
So still, Peter. So deathly still.
It isn't much of a place I brought you to, is it? A few deserted houses, broken doors.
It'll be our new home.
Our new home. It's wonderful the way you say that.
I feel as if every step we've taken in life we're headed to this little spot, Peter. As if I always knew that this is the place to call home. Days went by. Days of worry, indecision, fear. While Peter tried to keep the minds of all of us from the thought of the Indians, who we knew were watching our every movement from the forest. The land around the fort was divided into plots. Boundaries were staked out. A schoolhouse was planned. But there was little spirit in the work, for each night the drums would sound. Throughout the night, steady, always sounding nearer, terrifying. And then on the eighth day, even at dawn, the drums didn't stop. We knew then that they were coming. We crowded within the stockade and waited.
They're coming! The Indians! They're all around the fort! Jan! Yes, Peter? Jan! Yes!
I'm going out to meet them.
Alone?
It's the only way. We've got to show them that we've come here in peace. I'll go alone. I walked out the gate of the stockade and stood for a moment. The edge of every dune was a mass of weirdly painted faces, feathered bonnets. Then, from one of the dunes, I saw an Indian walk out toward the fort. I met him halfway. He was tall, handsome.
Me, Chief Horn, Chief of Nanticokes.
I am Peter Cornelius Plockhoy. I come as a friend.
White man always come as friend. He sits in council, smokes pipe, makes fine promises. Then when fires are low, he steals. Murders.
We haven't come to steal or murder. We've come to build houses and grow corn, to trade.
What do you have to trade?
Axes and cloth for beaver skins and corn. And in time, we'll trade even better things.
What is better than beaver skins and corn?
The ideas men have. You will teach us how to plant and hunt. We'll teach you how to live with law and in peace with your neighbors. You'll teach us of the forest. We'll teach you of God.
How do you know? I believe what you say.
Because you are a man of peace. If you were otherwise, you would have swept down on us without warning, slaughtered us. Instead, you walk out alone from among your warriors. I think you will be a good neighbor to have.
I think you are a good man. I protect you. You live here in peace.
From that day on, our colony took on new life. Our fields were laid out, seeded, each man knowing that whatever profits he took from the land would be his own. We lived in peace with the Indians. They taught us where to fish the streams, hunt game, to raise corn, harvest wild grapes. In the year that followed, our roots dug deep into the soil. We were content. And then, suddenly, the world crashed down around us.
My brother, I bring evil news.
What is it, Chief Horn?
The English come to New Amstel. They come in two great seabirds that spit fire. Now all Dutch in New Amstel prisoners. And seabirds come this way.
English ships coming this way, are you sure?
Sure. I bring my warriors. Fight with you.
But this is Dutch territory. How can they come here?
They can. They've denied the Dutch claim to New Netherlands for years, Catherine. They evidently mean to settle the matter of ownership once and for all.
We fight them.
No, we can't, Chief Horn. Take your people back from the stockade.
We fight.
How can we fight? With what? Bows and arrows against cannon? No, it would be murder, suicide. Your people have been good friends to us. We'll not repay your friendship by letting you sacrifice your lives in a hopeless struggle. Get them away from Swanendale, far away.
I do as you ask. But we stay near. We watch. If you need your brothers, call to us, and we will come.
The very next day, the ships appeared off Swanendale. We all watched as the soldiers filled the longboats and the sailors rowed them to the shore. As quickly as they touched the beach, the soldiers formed into squads and marched toward the village.
Happening, Catherine. What have we done wrong in the sight of God?
Nothing, Peter. Nothing. It is a testing. A testing of our faith. And we will not be found wanting.
Come in here! Halt! Who is the leader of the settlement?
I'm the elected head.
Your name?
Peter Cornelius Plakhoy.
In the name of His Royal Highness James, Duke of York, I require of you and your company submission and obedience by virtue of the commission I hold in my possession.
What is it you want of us?
This settlement is to be evacuated and burnt to the ground in 24 hours.
Evacuated? Burned? Why?
Plakhoy, all this is very distressing to me. I hope you won't make it more difficult by arguing with me.
Well, do you expect us to leave our homes on a moment's notice and not protest?
You got to understand the realities of the situation, sir. I haven't enough troops to garrison this place and New Amstel, too. And my orders state that I can't leave any settlement without protection from the Indians.
But the Indians are our friends.
You can't depend upon the friendship of Indians.
Well, what then can we depend upon? The good offices of a government that has in mind the destruction of everything we've done since we arrived in America? Our settlement has prospered, sir. We've accomplished much. Come and see our little village, the schoolhouse, the mill, the farmland that each man owns as his neighbor's equal.
Believe me, Plakhoy, this is a matter of colonial policy. I cannot leave you here without soldiers for protection, and I have no soldiers to spare. I'm sorry, sincerely sorry. Let me take you all to New Amstel.
And if we prefer not to go there?
You can't stay here. It's either New Amstel or...
Or the wilderness.
Yes.
I see. May we have some time to decide?
Yes, of course.
How long?
1 hour.
1 hour. That's not very long, is it, sir?
No.
No. Against the hope of a lifetime, 1 hour is very short indeed.
about that we had our last meeting. I gathered our little company together, the people who had come to Swanendale. They stood quietly before me.
Peter, what shall we do?
I think each of us has to search in his own heart for a decision.
But what will you do?
Catherine and I have talked about it. We feel together on this. We've come so far in our seeking for freedom that we can't turn back on the road. Safety is not half so important to us as liberty. And we believe liberty lies beyond the sand dunes, in the vast heart of this country. And we're going to it.
Into the forest?
Deep in the forest, John. In some other valley, we'll find a place to build.
Lead us to this valley, Peter.
God will lead us. We're in agreement then?
Aye.
Good. We'll go into the forest together.
The Cavalcade of America on Tuned to Yesterday from May 27th, 1952 on NBC. And that brings to a close this hour of True History on Tuned to Yesterday. Be sure to be with us next time for more great programs from radio's past. Until our next hour together, I'm Mark Levanier. Thanks for tuning in.